Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson, and today I'm bringing you part one of a talk Stephen Meyer gave at the 2019 Dallas Science and Faith Conference. The title of Meyer's talk, God and the Origin of the Universe.
All right, I'd like to begin by talking a little bit more about this media blackout that Eric Metaxas was talking about. Richard Dawkins is one of those popularizers that we all encounter in that cultural flood of information that Eric was talking about. Here's a quotation that has influenced Dawkins and many of his so-called scientific atheists, or the new atheist movement. They started publishing books in 2007, and they've been monster, million sellers. And this is a quote from one of those books. He says, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." You may remember that one of his first best-selling books was The Blind Watchmaker. And Dawkins's argument runs like this. He says that science properly understood undermines belief in God. Why? Because before Darwin, we knew that the strongest argument for the existence of God was always the evidence of design in nature. But when Darwin came along, we were able to explain that appearance of design, that illusion of design, as the result of a blind, undirected process called natural selection acting on random variations. And now biologists would talk about natural selection also acting on random mutations. But that undirected process explains the appearance or illusion of design. So now we know there's no real design, only an illusion of design, and therefore there's no designer, and if there's no designer, there's no God. And so he says, if you want to believe in God, you're still free to do so as a sort of subjective superstition. He calls it the God delusion, but there's no objective evidence for the reality of God. And that's one of those really powerful cultural messages. And I know, having been a professor, this really profoundly has affected a lot of students, people in that pre, post, and college age years when most of us form our worldviews. In fact, there's a lot of polling data on this, that young people are losing their faith in droves as they go to university. Many of them do come back later, many don't. But science and the perception that there is, quote, no scientific evidence for God is one of the really powerful reasons for that loss. And a lot of that is coming from this cultural messaging from these folks we call the new atheists, and also the professorate who has been influenced for over a century by the rise of what we call scientific materialism, a worldview about which I'll talk a bit more as the talk unfolds. Now, obviously, this perspective that science is in conflict with faith, or that science properly understood undermines belief in God, is very contrary to the perspective of the biblical writers. In Psalm 19, in the Tanakh, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, we encounter the idea that the heavens are actually in some way declaring or revealing the glory and reality of God. You get the same idea in the New Testament. St. Paul talks about, in Romans 1, the famous passage, he says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and his divine nature," sometimes in the older translations of the Bible translated wisdom, "have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made." In other words, if you look at nature, there's something about nature that not only affirms the reality of God, but actually reveals something about the qualities of the Creator, his power and his wisdom, his intelligence. Now, this is obviously a very different perspective than that of the new atheists, and I suppose we shouldn't be too surprised that the Bible writers and the new atheists disagree about what nature can tell us about the reality of God. But what might surprise you is that the new atheist perspective on what science can tell us about the reality of God is diametrically opposed to the perspective of the founders of what we call modern science. Historians of science talk about a period of time from roughly 1300 to 1700. Others date it 1500 to 1700. They call it the scientific revolution. That's when science, in its modern form, as an organized form of inquiry and investigation of nature, really got going. And when we think of that period of time, we think about the giants of the scientific revolution, like Johannes Kepler, the great astronomer. We think about Galileo. We think about Robert Boyle, the groundbreaking chemist. And we think about, for example, Sir Isaac Newton. Here's a front piece of one of the early works in biology, late 17th century, one of the kind of really cutting-edge pieces of biological research at that period of time. Notice the front piece, the introductory page here. It's a paraphrase of the book of Romans, that passage I just read, the wisdom of God manifested in the works of creation. There were a lot of them, so it was in two parts. It was two big volumes by John Ray, a fellow of the Royal Society, the first organized scientific society in the world. Ray, like many of the founders of science during this period of time, was a devout Christian who believed that by studying nature, he was learning about the wisdom of God. Now, the scientists at this period of time had two key concepts that historians of science have identified as crucial to the rise of modern science. One was the idea of order. And the idea there was that nature is an orderly system. They would talk about the concourse of nature, an orderly system. And it was orderly because it reflected the mind of God. God was a God of order, and he built order into the world. And therefore, we could perceive those patterns of order, which the early scientists called laws of nature. And they were laws because there was a lawgiver. It was a juridical, theological metaphor that suggested that the order of nature was a manifestation of the ongoing superintending by God of his power over nature. I talked last night in the interview with Eric about Newton's notion of the laws of nature. He thought that they were a manifestation of constant spirit action. It was the Spirit of God who imposed upon the brute matter an order that could be perceived by the scientists, which we describe mathematically as laws of nature. That was one key idea from this period of time. The other was the idea, perhaps even more profound, of intelligibility. To most of us without scientific training, nature can look very chaotic, hard to discern what's going on. But the early scientists had the conviction that if they studied nature carefully, that it would reveal its secrets. It was intelligible to them because we human beings are made in the image of God. God is a rational creator. He built rationality, order, and put design into nature. And because he built our minds as well in his image, we could perceive the rationality, the order, and the design that he built into the natural world. And so this made science possible, and it made this incredible flowering of organized science possible in Western Europe during this period of time in a decidedly Christian milieu, a period when most of the leading intellectuals had, if not a genuine faith, a Christian worldview. Now, this perspective reached an almost majestic quality in the writings of Sir Isaac Newton. I had an experience several years ago now, where I was called to testify before a group called the United States Commission on Civil Rights. And they were investigating whether or not there was something called viewpoint discrimination in the teaching of biological origins. When I got the invitation to testify, my first thought was, well, I wouldn't have thought you needed a hearing to establish that. All you have to do is open any college or high school biology textbook, and there's only one perspective offered. It's the contemporary Darwinian perspective. And in the discussion or presentation of evolutionary theory, there is not in these textbooks even a discussion of some of the contemporary critiques of, for example, the creative power of the mutation selection mechanism, which many evolutionary biologists now doubt, but not a mention of that. So, of course, there's viewpoint discrimination. But in any case, the commissioners were interested in my perspective as a proponent of the theory of intelligent design. I came and gave a short testimony, and afterwards, one of the commissioners in the back row started asking kind of series of aggressive questions that I thought were meant to impeach my credibility. He was asking about where I did my PhD and what would my supervisors have thought of my perspective on ID, blah, blah, blah. But then he said, isn't your perspective, though, very similar to that of Johannes Kepler and Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton, some of the early founders of modern science? And I, when I heard the name of my heroes, my spirit brightened. And And I began to talk a little bit about that. And then my opposite number at the hearing, who was there defending the Darwin-only approach to science education, interjected and said, well, what Dr. Meyer is saying is true. Sir Isaac Newton was a very religious man, she said. But he took great pains to keep his religious ideas about intelligent design, notice how she equated the two, out of his scientific work. And I'm not one of these people that memorizes poetry or even Bible verses very readily, but it happened that I had in my briefcase with me an essay that I'd finished just that week with a paragraph, a block quote from Isaac Newton, and it's the one that I have on the screen behind me. And I had it nearly committed to memory. And so I found myself saying something that sounded very impressive. I said, well, but actually that's not true. In the general scolium to the Principia, general scolium just means introduction, but she didn't know that, neither did the commissioners. And I quoted this pretty close to verbatim. Let me share it with you. This is Newton. He's talking about the solar system. He's presenting in the Principia his theory of universal gravitation. But knowing how this law now works, he's got it mathematically described, he's still amazed that the solar system is a stable, has all these stable planetary orbits, because he's aware of how there's this delicate balancing of all the gravitational forces. And this is what he says. Though these bodies, the planets, may indeed continue in their orbits by the mere laws of gravity, yet they could by no means have at first derived the regular position of the orbits themselves from those laws. Thus, this most beautiful system of sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being, capital B. And as I finished paraphrasing, the commissioners in the back of the room, I saw several smiles break across faces, like, oh, this could be a lot more interesting than we thought. You know, I'm the young upstart, and here's the person speaking for the scientific establishment. Because whether or not the commissioners were persuaded of my views on intelligent design, they realized that, as a matter of a historical fact, the founders of modern science were very favorable to this idea, and they built it into their scientific work. It wasn't something they kept separate as a theological proposition. They thought science itself was pointing to the design of an intelligent and powerful being. Now, obviously, that's a very big shift in perspective from that of Richard Dawkins and Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bill Nye the Science Guy and all these popularizers we've been hearing about. So how did we get from from Sir Isaac Newton to Richard Dawkins? That's a big intellectual shift. And there's a story to be told about this in intellectual history or scientific history, and it really begins in the 19th century. And there's a kind of a series of scientific ideas that come about that end up producing that worldview shift. In some ways, it starts with another physicist named Pierre Laplace. He in 1799, Newton dies in 1727. The Principia is 1687. So about a century later, 1799. Laplace writes this book called The Celestial Mechanics. And in The Celestial Mechanics, he attempts to do what Newton in that previous quotation said you couldn't do, which was explain the origin of the solar system purely by reference to the law of gravity and some clustering of nebular gases. Newton thought it was a setup job. He thought it was finely tuned somehow, that God had designed the solar system. And Laplace tries to dispense with that idea. He's brought before Napoleon a few years later, to receive commendation for this important book. And according to the story as it's told, Napoleon asks him, you know, wonderful book, we're glad you showed up the British, but I know that Newton used to write a lot about God in his scientific works, but you don't. Why is that? And he is said to have puffed himself up and said, Sire, I have no need of that hypothesis. That was my French accent, sorry about that part. This now is one of those things that historians of science debate about whether this conversation actually happened. Some say it's apocryphal, others not. Whatever is the case, it certainly captured the spirit of the age and the spirit of the coming age, especially in the 19th century. One by one, there were theories that came online that disputed the idea that there was any evidence of design in nature, and that instead, purely undirected natural processes could explain all the origin of all the things we see around us. So we have this account of Laplace of the solar system. Then in geology, we have some very reasonable explanations, but relying on purely undirected, unguided processes to explain the origin of the mountain ranges and the canyons and the great geological features. And then in biology, we have, of course, Darwin's great theory, 1859, the origin of species. He attempts to explain the origin of all the new forms of life as a result of unguided, undirected processes, in particular natural selection acting on random variations. His idea is extended, first by, he does it himself, to explain the origin even of human beings in his book, The Descent of Man. And then other early evolutionary theorists, Ernst Haeckel and Thomas Henry Huxley, extend the idea in the other direction to account for the origin of the first cell from the simpler chemicals in what we now sometimes refer to as the prebiotic soup. And so by the end of the 19th century, you have this seamless, completely naturalistic, completely materialistic story from the origin back, very far back, to explain the origin of the solar system, to planet Earth, to the features on planet Earth, to the first life, to all the new forms of life, finally to the human life. And so this is a completely materialistic account. And as a result of this, by the end of the 19th century, you don't just have a series of theories about origin, sorry for the rhyme, but you also have something like a comprehensive worldview developing. And scholars call this this worldview scientific materialism. How many are familiar with the term worldview? I mean, that's really good. It's getting into wider currency. When I was in college, I was a physics and earth science major. I majored in both fields. And one of the reasons I did the science stuff was my dad was a mechanical engineer. When I went off to college, I knew I didn't want to be an engineer. Whenever he was fixing the engine in the car and he had me help, I'd drop the wrench in the most inaccessible place. And he'd go like, you know, because I was thinking about other things. And so he said, before I went to college, he said, look, son, I know you don't want to be an engineer. You don't have to follow me in my footsteps. But before you choose a major, please take at least 2 years of college math. Because if you don't have that math under your belt, you're going to be limited in what you can do. And I said, okay, sure, Dad. If I don't have to be an engineer, I'll do anything. I'll take the math. So I get done with the 2 years of college math, and about all you can major in at the liberal arts college where I was attending was physics. And physics was about as close to engineering as you could get in the college where I was, and I think my dad got what he wanted, you know, so this is awesome. But I was always sneaking across campus to sign up for one philosophy class every year, because you heard in the interview last night I was always interested in these deep why questions. And one semester, I was taking a course called Atheistic Existentialism. It was my junior year, and it was all about Nietzsche and Sartre and Camus and the depressed, God is dead, atheistic existentialist writers, and anguish, forlornness, and despair. And I was doing really, really well at the despair part. And I got an A in this class, and the grade slip came home at Christmas time. We have this kind of Germanic work ethic thing in our family. Even as a college student, my dad is intercepting the report card. And so one night he says, you know, I'd like to have a little chat. And we're sitting at dinner, and he says, he gets the grade slip out, and he starts reading the grades. And the first one is atheistic. And he says, atheistic, what in the blank? He says, is atheistic, existentialism, he says. And then he pauses for effect, and it reads it, and it says, A. Like that's a bad thing. And then the next grade is theoretical mechanics. And that was my most important physics class, that term, and he reads it as B. And then he gives me this look like it is now time for offspring to give account of offspring's behavior. And I start getting really defensive, and I say, Dad, look, I know these philosophy classes don't mean anything to you, but they're important too, because that's where you learn about worldviews and about what people are thinking at that deep level. And everybody has a worldview. It's kind of like a personal philosophy, and it informs your perspective on other issues. And if you understand people's worldview, you can understand where they're coming from and why they use the terms they do. And he interrupts me and he says, son, you don't need a worldview. You need a job. Now I'm one of those dads, you know, so I get that now, and my dad, being a mechanical engineer, is actually now really excited about what we're doing on intelligent design, but it took a while. And Anyway, the point is worldview is very important. It is a kind of a good way of thinking of a worldview is it's a personal philosophy that everyone has, whether they know it or not. And worldviews answer some very fundamental questions about reality. Not questions like what is the formula for salt or who won the World Series, but deeper questions like what is the thing or the entity or the process from which everything else comes. In fact, that's in people who write about worldview, that they call that the prime reality question, the most important question. And the dominant worldview in our elite knowledge culture today is this worldview that I would just mention called materialism, or sometimes called naturalism. The idea that nature is all there is. There's nothing beyond it. Nature made of matter and energy. And so if you're familiar scripturally with something like the prologue to the book of John, where it says, in the beginning was the Word, or from back to Genesis, in the beginning, God said. You know, there's the idea in the theistic worldview that what is the prime reality is a personal God with a mind of creative intentions who brings the universe into existence and then through his intellectual power shapes matter to create and generate all the things we see around us. The materialistic worldview, you know, sort of the flip side of that John 9 prologue, says, from eternity past were the particles. There was no beginning. The thing that is eternal and self-existent is matter and energy. And that matter and energy arranged itself to become more complex stuff, more complex living stuff eventually. And the living stuff evolved by Darwinian processes to produce all the new forms of life we see, including one form of life, namely us, who conceived of the idea of God. And so you have God in the materialistic worldview, but only as a concept and only at the end of the process. In the theistic worldview, the whole thing is reversed. You start with God, then you get matter, and then you get all the wonderful things we see around us as a result of God's creativity. So these two worldviews are in a kind of ideological conflict, and the conflict between science and faith is not a conflict between scientific evidence and faith. It's really a conflict between these two worldviews, one of which claims to be based on science, but I'm going to suggest that maybe that's not actually the case.
You've been listening to an excerpt from a talk by Stephen C. Meyer at the 2019 Dallas Science and Faith Conference, a talk that draws on the subject of his upcoming book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, Compelling Evidence for the Existence of God. You can pre-order Meyer's newest book at a steep discount by going to Amazon and searching for Return of the God Hypothesis. Check it out and reserve your copy of the book today. For ID the Future, this is Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.